Well, we're back for our final kind of lesson on America as a world power at the turn of the century. And we'll kind of connect this lesson to World War I, because we'll finish this lesson as America goes to war or watches other countries go to war in 1914. The United States will not go declare war in the Great War, World War I, until 1917. Remember isolationism? We talked a little bit about that earlier. But let me set the stage for you. It's 1899, the year after the Spanish-American War, and Rudyard Kipling, a very famous British writer who spent most of his time in India, one of the colonies of the British, which will not get its independence until 1947, is sitting around, and he writes a poem. And the poem is called The White Man's Burden. And some of the lines in it are, "Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed." You know, think about that for a minute. That really does describe imperialism, taking up the burden, the white man's burden. One of the things that you find is imperialism was heavily steeped in race. And here's a great example. Take up the white man's burden. Teddy Roosevelt himself believed that the white man, or as he called it, the Nordic races, the Teutonic man, were the most superior of any other civilization. So Rudyard Kipling, having this colonial experience, living in India for a lot of times, as a British man, will write The White Man's Burden. And this is an encouragement, particularly to the United States, again published the year after the Spanish-American War, for the United States to get in the game, to get in the game of colonies, to become that essential world power. And again, just a quick review. In Hawaii, American planters had organized the overthrow of Queen Lilikualani, had actually put her under house arrest, and then a treaty will be signed to the Americans to give them permission to annex the country. In the Philippines, the war erupted over the Philippine desire to be a pendant and to get out from under their Spanish rulers. William Howard Taft, who will later be president, is going to be their first governor. Okay, remember, this was very, very rough, because once the Spanish are removed from the Philippines, the United States and the Filipino peoples will fight a brutal, brutal war to suppress the Philippine rebellion. And eventually, the United States will get control of the Philippines until 1946. Puerto Rico became a territory of the United States, and the Puerto Rican people will become citizens in 1917. Just recently, in the last couple of years, Puerto Rico, it was thought that Puerto Rico might become the 51st state within the United States. But to their credit, the Puerto Rican people voted not to do that. They wanted to continue being a protectorate, but did not want to integrate into a state. Well, what about Cuba? There are two very important amendments that you want to remember when you think about Cuba. As previously mentioned, the United States will annex Hawaii. The United States will not annex Cuba. And that's because of the Teller Amendment, an amendment that was particularly written into the Cuban Constitution. And the Teller Amendment said that, hey, Cuba will have independence. However, the United States also made sure to write into the Cuban Constitution the Platt Amendment. And the Platt Amendment gave the United States certain economic interests in Cuba. For example, the Platt Amendment is going to say, in a roundabout sort of way, that the United States can intervene in Cuba if our business interests are threatened, okay? And also, it's through these amendments and through these agreements that at least two naval bases, most famously Guantanamo Bay, will be given to the United States as an important coaling and fueling station. So, we've mentioned Hawaii, we've mentioned Cuba, we've mentioned Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. Where else was the United States at, and where else were we becoming a world power in the last decades of the 19th century, moving into the 20th century? Secretary of State John Hay, at this time, in the 1890s will write the first series of open door notes to China. And basically, if you've ever tried to open a door, okay, and there's something behind it, it's very frustrating to try to get that door open. And in a lot of ways, Secretary of State Hay was concerned that the United States would somehow be blocked from trading in China, particularly. And so he writes a series of open door notes to the Chinese government arguing to leaving the door open for American trade in China. Don't lock out American trade in China. The notes are very successful, okay, except to a group of spiritual peoples in China, and they did not like foreigners from Germany or France or Britain. And in the early 1900s, there'll be a Boxer Rebellion of spiritual Chinese. They called themselves the Boxers. And they revolted against the, you know, foreign peoples in the capital of Peking. And U.S. Marines and British Marines had to go in and rescue the foreigners in China. But open door notes, you want to remember open door notes. Sometimes open door notes shows up on the exam most of all. So you want to remember open door notes. John Hay, China. Every time you hear about open door notes, remember John Hay. Remember China. About 1904, as Teddy Roosevelt becomes president, about 1901, one of the things that Roosevelt does is he's a big believer in action. He's a big believer in American power. And in 1904, you'll have the Russo-Japanese War over some islands in Asia. And Teddy Roosevelt will bring the leaders of Russia and Japan to the United States, and he will mediate a treaty called the Portsmouth Treaty. And Roosevelt is showing himself as a man of action, as a world leader, okay? But he also gets Russia and Japan to wrestle together and to come up with a treaty, okay? Again, this is a way of America becoming a world power, becoming a greater mediator. In the late 1800s, the United States had mediated a Chilean crisis with American sailors with an incident in Chile. They had also mediated a crisis between British Guyana, okay, and Venezuela. So the United States is becoming a mediator. You know, again, you know, these connections to the Monroe Doctrine, if there's something happening in the Caribbean. And Roosevelt, you know, has a very famous foreign policy slogan that says, "Speak softly, but carry a big stick." So, you know, here's a guy who could get people together to talk and to mediate a peace treaty, but he can also wield that big stick. About 1904, the United States had been asking Colombia if the United States could build a canal across their isthmus, the shortest point between the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. Colombia said no. And so what does Teddy Roosevelt do? He orders the USS Nashville, a battleship off the coast of Colombia. He, along with leaders in the American government, drop leaflets on the Colombian people, encouraging the Colombian people to revolt around this area of the isthmus and become their own country. And in a one-day revolution, you will have these folks in Colombia becoming the country of Panama. And conveniently, the United States will sign a treaty with this new country, Panama, okay, and it will allow the United States to build what becomes the Panama Canal. It's a 10-year project, okay, and so the project will start under Teddy Roosevelt. It will continue through the presidency of Roosevelt's vice president, William Howard Taft, and it will end with President Woodrow Wilson, and be open just days before the outbreak of World War I in Europe in 1914. Each of these three presidents, oh, and by the way, the United States is successful in building the canal because of two things. Remember, by 1900, the United States is the world leader in railroads. So being able to dig with these huge, huge steel steam shovels and to be able to remove dirt and other debris by railroad in places like the Culebra Cut, where there was so much dirt removed to, you know, rebuild or build a model of the pyramids in Egypt, okay? Imagine the amount of dirt that had to be removed to build this canal, and you couldn't do it without railroads. The French had tried to build a canal like this, you know, had tried to build the first Panama Canal, but they could not keep their workers healthy. And American doctors, like Dr. Walter Reed, will go into these areas and look at the French work camps and realize that the mosquito, malaria, yellow fever had decimated the French work crews. And so one of the things that Americans will do is to improve the health and the living conditions of the workers that are building the Panama Canal. If you can keep a worker in the field working, you know, you can get the project done. And so one of the things that Dr. Reed is going to do is clean up the camps, fill in the puddles, you know, in this tropical environment so that mosquito larva doesn't breed and or doesn't, you know, move into actual mosquitoes. So American ingenuity, American technology, American health is going to be a big reason why the Americans will build the canal and not the French. Each of these presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, Woodrow Wilson, will have their own ways of doing foreign policy. As we said a minute ago, Teddy Roosevelt's way is speak softly and carry a big stick. You know, in other words, tell people what you want to do or what you want them to do, and if they don't, then take it by force. William Howard Taft is not necessarily that way all the time. He will do something called dollar diplomacy. You know, one of the things that the United States will do is we will give monies to Latin American countries to buy their friendship. We will also send troops to take over Latin American countries if American businesses were threatened or if those countries owed the United States loans. And many, many, many times during this period, with William Howard Taft and Woodrow Wilson, most notably in Nicaragua, the United States Marines will be sent to that country to take over that country's customs house so that the United States will recoup their financial losses. And a customs house, remember, is just a port where duties are paid. And so the United States would take over countries' customs houses, collect their money, and then send the Marines home. Okay? So, you know, it was at least 50 times between the late 1800s and the early 1900s when U.S. Marines are sent to places like Haiti and Nicaragua. You know, sometimes these are peacekeeping missions, but a lot of times those soldiers, bottom line, were there to protect American interests, to protect American companies. Woodrow Wilson has a more high-minded diplomacy, a missionary diplomacy. You know, we're going to see this during World War I when Woodrow Wilson basically comes up with his 14 points, his idea for a new world order as countries end the Great War. And we'll talk about some of those 14 points later, but a good example of this high-minded diplomacy is, for instance, Woodrow Wilson wanted all countries to protect freedom of the seas. He wanted territorial borders to be erased in some places so that native peoples could make their own decisions. That's a good example of high-minded or missionary diplomacy. This doesn't mean that he did not order troops into Haiti or Nicaragua at times, most notably Nicaragua. But he pursued a more intellectual kind of diplomacy instead of big stick diplomacy of Mr. Roosevelt. Well, let's be honest. As the Spanish-American War occurs, especially as America progressively becomes more of a world power, and as World War I begins, although the United States will be neutral, okay, as World War I begins, the Allies will look to the United States as an important industrial country to provide needed goods and services. The year before World War I breaks out in Europe, in Columbus, New Mexico, a gentleman, a Mexican man by the name of Pancho Villa, will raid the city of Columbus, New Mexico. And the United States military will be sent into Mexico as Mexico is fighting its civil war to find Pancho Villa. The gentleman who heads up the army is an awesome, awesome figure. His name was Black Jack during the Spanish-American War. Black Jack Pershing, because he led some of those segregated troops, black troops, during the war. And he's going to become one of the most phenomenal leaders in American military history, especially during World War I. But Black Jack Pershing and American troops will be sent to find the Mexican bandit, as he's known in American newspapers, Pancho Villa. He is never found, but you must understand that General John Black Jack Pershing's next assignment will be leading all of American forces in Europe in a year and a half, in 1917 and 1918, where he'll make profound decisions that change everything about the United States as we move into the Great War. Thank you.